We hold in our hearts Jim and Sandra Jordan, Pell Paul, Evelyn, Bob, Ruth, Jerry, Jim, Michael, Ann, and Tony, Jim, Ross, Graham, Holly, Emma, father and mother, Sandra and Jim, Dorothy, Sheila, Jim, Sandra and family, Luke, Tom and Jerome, Alexandria, and Anne.
Thank you. That was lovely. A shift in perspective, seeing a new way, is not always the result of a major or serious event. Such shifts can also happen when one least expects it. These can be equally lasting and powerful if we're open to the change. One of my pivotal moments, a moment I often still use to check my views on the world, did not come after meditating and fasting for a week. Did not come after walking the whole Camino or reading great philosophers or mystics. There was absolutely nothing grandiose or intentional about it. One of my greatest shifts in perception, when I really did see with fresh eyes, has to do with wallpaper. And the flash, my wallpaper epiphany, came as I brushed my teeth. Allow me to set the scene for a minute. Many years ago, I decided to wallpaper the small downstairs, unpainted for 6 years, bathroom. I picked the wallpaper, carved out a couple of hours, and started. First part of the roll on, first wall done. Halfway through the second roll, I ran out of wallpaper, which rather surprised me, as I thought it was a double roll. Oh well, no problem. I had another one. Somewhere. Somewhere safe. Somewhere very, very safe, where it still sits waiting for me to this day. So, there was a wall and a half done. Now what? Well, go to town, to the store, which, as I was living on Denman Island at the time, involved 2 ferry rides and a lot of waiting. The pattern was discontinued? Rats. Maybe something that sort of matched. No. Okay, home to problem solve. How about painting the rest of the half wall in a tone that went with the wallpaper? No, that would look really strange. I know. How about a piece of trim down the middle so that it looks intentional? Anyone who has lived in a home-built house knows trim covers many sins. Okay, I actually tried that one. No, it looked really dumb. So here's the part which still makes me shake my head in disbelief. We all lived with that half-done wall for a year while I tried to figure out what to do. 1 whole year. Lots of people coming and going. We were a family of 7 plus. No one. Let me repeat, no one offered the obvious answer. Now, I am sure many of you have already seen the obvious solution, but the point I am making is I did not, and many people did not. All I could see for months and months was a half-finished wall that needed completing. I was completely blind to the bigger picture. About a year later, I'm brushing my teeth, and this revolutionary, life-changing idea comes into my head. What if? What if I just ripped off the wallpaper back to the corner and simply had 1 finished wall and painted the rest? I was awestruck at what a great idea that was, until I was equally awestruck that it had taken me a whole year to see that solution. How was that even possible? that something so obvious was so hidden. All I could see was the problem, one small part of a greater whole. Then suddenly, toothbrush in hand, I could see the whole picture. What happened? How did I come to know that what had before had been hidden? I have no real explanation, but I'm really grateful for the shift. That flash of insight remains vivid to me to this day, that moment when a new perspective changed everything and allowed me to move on. Ever since then, when I'm stuck, when I think there's only one way forward, I will remember the wallpaper moment. I stop and consider other ways of seeing. It is still a wonderful and humbling reminder of how I can blind myself to what is possible and how very wonderful and life-changing it can be to see through fresh eyes. And just to finish the story, was the family pleased and proud when I finally figured it all out and finished the bathroom after all that time? No one noticed. Our sermon for today will be given by Dr. Paul Bramadat, a scholar in religious studies and the director of the UVic Center for Studies in Religion and Society. Please welcome Dr. Bramadat.
Hello, everybody. It's been a long time since I've been here. So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me today and to thank Farrell and Penny for that wonderful musical gift. It is so lovely to see Farrell and Penny. I have to say, my wife and I were members of the Hamilton Unitarian Church in Hamilton many, many years ago, and I swear you guys have not aged a day. I don't know. It's so bizarre. I don't know what it is about this place. So I'm going to take a bit of a risk today, and I'm going to make this sermon a PowerPoint-based sermon. Now, I wouldn't ordinarily do this. In fact, normally when I give sermons, I write the whole thing out, and I kind of speak it from top to bottom. But actually, I just want to try something different because I find that I'm more stiff and stilted when I do that. So, and also, what I want to talk about today is, for some of you, going to be somewhat scandalous, and for others, it's going to be fairly content-rich, fairly high-calorie argument. So I kind of want to give you something else to look at or something else to throw things at as I'm giving my lecture. So I want to begin by observing that we are all characters in kind of two overlapping stories. One I want to call kind of the Canadian Western liberal democratic story, which is a story that is characterized really by gradually increasing political and personal freedom and pluralism, democracy, liberalism, good governance, rights, et cetera, with some internal holdouts. In other words, there is some resistance and some imported slow adopters who can be civilized or liberalized, we think. Okay? Now, this, interestingly enough, overlaps fairly neatly with the Unitarian story, which is identical to the kind of general Western liberal democratic story, with the difference of that, right? So we're seeing here, and we are characters in this other story, this Western and Unitarian story. Now, there is a lot to be celebrated in the emergence of these two stories and in ourselves as characters in these two stories. But it's important to slow down occasionally whenever one finds oneself, you know, in the middle of something and to sort of ask some difficult questions. So today I really want to be watching the vanguard. This PLU, which is a term a friend of mine from the States uses to mean people like us. Yeah? Prius driving, comfortable shoe, having, you know, sensible hair style, managing, comfortable sweater wearing folks. You know who you are. People like us, people who are now, in a sense, the vanguard of those two stories. So there are some counter stories to challenge or that seek to undo the two dominant stories that we're all characters in. But there is, I would say, especially among PLU, kind of a general consensus. And as much as many of us might rail against the current political elite right now in Ottawa and in other Western societies, there is a kind of a, if you look at it kind of from a macro picture, there is a kind of a general shift in many Western liberal democracies, even in Europe, where some very alarming things are occurring, there is a kind of a general consensus around some of these kind of rights-based stories. But here's the deal. So whenever you see any kind of a consensus develop around any story or any slate of laws or policies or whatever, it's important to ask questions, to be cautious, to be suspicious of oneself, and to be suspicious of the kinds of privilege that these acts of consensus confer. And sometimes, if one is willing and courageous enough to be self-critical in these moments of consensus, the picture is not so flattering. And I want to kind of do something today. I want to do two things today, really. I want to use a recent political debate that many of us have observed to do two things. First of all, to wonder about the nature of this particular consensus, or one feature of the particular consensus around sexuality and law. And then to consider alternative approaches, or at least to call out some of the problematic features of the consensus. In some sense, I want to ask about what it might mean to pursue an avenue of what we might call deep diversity. Okay, so what might that mean for us? If we're going to take some of our multicultural, Unitarian, liberal, democratic, pluralistic, diversity commitments seriously, what might that mean? How might we kind of police ourselves from falling into some of the same bad intellectual habits that we are so critical of in others? Today I'm really a critic, not a caretaker, I would say, or a prodder, not a prophet. And so I ask your forgiveness as I poke and prod a little bit. And if there's anything wrong with my argument or you feel unduly poked, I encourage you to do what I do, which is to blame my mother. So, and we know where she's sitting. Huh? There we go. So, I want to talk today about the Trinity Western University Law School proposal and some of the debates around that, okay? And this is going to be pretty uncomfortable it's going to be uncomfortable for me. I don't know about you guys, but it's going to be uncomfortable for me. Let me give you a bit of a background. For those of you who only paid attention to a little bit of it, let me just kind of give you a kind of a sketch of what happened. So Trinity Western University is an evangelical Christian private university. This is an important piece of the story in the Lower Mainland, okay? They have a covenant that everybody is expected to sign. Staff, students, and faculty members are all expected to sign this covenant. Probably most of you have not read the covenant. It's a very long document. It's a very well-considered document, actually. And most of it, the majority of it, really has to do with treating people well, not lying or cheating, not committing plagiarism, being compassionate and sensitive. And being in kind of in right relations, to use a kind of a Buddhist term, with one another. There is also, as one would expect, in fact, as one finds in many other kinds of covenants like this, there are passages on sexuality. And what they say is that people who come to Trinity are expected to abstain from sexual activities that fall outside of the normal relationship or the normal boundaries of heterosexual monogamous life. Okay? I'm not sure they actually use the word homosexual in the covenant, but that's clearly what they're worried about. Though indeed, in truth and in addition, they are worried about what we might call the hookup culture that is very popular among undergraduate folks. Regrettably, I missed that generation. But I hear from among my students that, the people just sort of, instead of shaking hands, they just sort of have sex. I don't see this as a faculty member, but apparently this is fairly common. So the covenant is meant also to interrupt that, okay? So it's opposed to any sexual activity outside of an ordinary, conventional Christian definition, okay? So that's the thing you're expected to sign if you're going to be a faculty member, student, staff, etc., right? Now, to make a long story short, Trinity Western was given some land and on which they were intending to build a law school. And so they made their announcement that they were going to use this great gift they've been given by a neighbor to build a law school. And initially, their proposal to build a law school was accepted by the government and by a number of law societies. But soon thereafter, as soon as this sort of got out into the broader public arena, It prompted all kinds of resistance from lawyers and from political activists, as one can imagine, as one would want to see, I think. To make a long story short, there were two really pivotal kind of debates. One was within the Law Society of Upper Canada, which is the group of the Professional Association of Lawyers of Ontario, and one was among the Law Society of British Columbia, which is, of course, a professional association of lawyers in British Columbia. A long story short, after great debate in both of these contexts, both of those professional societies said, well, you can graduate lawyers if you want, but they just can't work in Ontario or in BC. The whole project of the law school was nixed. So Trinity, of course, acted like they were totally shocked by this. Right? They said, well, what's the problem? And the reason they thought, what's the problem, was because in 2001 they won a Supreme Court decision in another controversy that was a controversy between themselves and the British Columbia College of Teachers. Okay? So the BCCT said, look, we're not going to let you, we're not going to certify your teachers if you have this covenant, which is requiring the students to abstain from lawful homosexual behavior. Okay? But the argument that they made at the time, the argument that the anti-Trinity Western University people made at the time, was that we don't want teachers to go out into the schools and be homophobic or be in any way hostile toward gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans students. Problem was, there's no real evidence that a person who goes to Trinity is going to be any nastier than any other teacher at any other B.Ed. program, which is why the Supreme Court rejected that. So Trinity felt, for this law school, they felt that, look, if we won the Supreme Court case with respect to the teaching, the B.Ed. program, surely we should win it with respect to the law program. Okay? Of course, the resistance from the law societies of Upper Canada and of B.C. was about discrimination on the basis of entry. In other words, the argument in the current debate is about whether or not LGBT students would be barred from entering the law school. It's not about how they're going to treat clients or how they're going to treat other lawyers. It's about who gets to be a lawyer, who gets to be going to law school. Okay? So in my view, it's actually they're totally different arguments, and so Trinity should not have been so shocked. So the current state of the situation is that basically the two major law societies that matter in this particular case have said no, which you'd figure would mean it's a kind of a done deal, but of course Trinity is going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if they can. And they're quite determined. So they have launched in December 18th, they launched an appeal to begin this whole process of making their argument. So now the feelings. The Law Society of Upper Canada said in his announcement, the treasurer said the decision was a difficult one. It was arrived at carefully and respectfully by a process that has been transparent, open, and fair. Okay? So these are just some of the feelings. So he's sort of making the argument that, look, you know, we had a full debate. We considered all sides. We heard from everybody. And those debates, by the way, were televised. So if you ever want to check them out, you can see them. It was quite an interesting debate. And it was transparent, fair, and we made our decision. The Janet F. Buckingham, who is kind of like the head representative for Trinity's argument, observed this. And, you don't have to read the whole thing, but basically she said she felt that they were sitting in judgment of the religious beliefs of this particular group of evangelical Christians. And she didn't feel that it was appropriate for them to impose a different view of what their community's sexual practices should be on them. Okay, so again, these are both very emotional statements, right? Both the statement of the Law Society of Upper Canada's treasurer and the statement of Janet F. Buckingham. Okay, so some of you have heard of trigger warnings. Professors are now encouraged, and in some universities, they're actually required to put trigger warnings in their course outlines if, in fact, somebody is going to be asked to read an academic article or a poem or a short story which might bug them, in any way, shape, or form. So here's my trigger warning, okay? I'm going to be making an argument that is really, in some sense, kind of counterintuitive for me to argue. Given my own biography, I was marrying gays and lesbians before it was legal, after it was legal. I have very strong commitments on this particular issue. I consider myself, I guess, straight but not narrow is how they would put it. So I am, you know, my credentials on this sexual political matter are in my view, appropriate for PLU. So I'm not actually interested in promoting one side or the other. I'm not sure if you've had any sermons here about this case, but my guess is if you did, it would be all promoting the anti-Trinity Western case. I'm not really interested in that. I am, if anything, interested in the sidification of the whole debate, the way in which, when this issue came in front of us all, our culture, it very quickly became polarized. And I'm kind of interested in sort of saying, well, what's that about? And how is it that one side won and the other side lost? If I was forced to vote yes or no to a very narrowly worded question, I would have voted no as well. But I want to make sure we think carefully about what it means to vote no. So, again, we think, of course, that saying no to Trinity was a victory for PLU, for good liberal religionists and for good social democrats and so forth. Because, after all, saying that you can't join a law school program at Trinity Western if you can't agree with the covenant, which excludes all but a kind of a very narrow conventional kind of sexuality, is discriminatory. There's no question about that. But in fact, the charter allows discrimination. Okay, we won't go into that detail, but the charter actually allows discrimination under particular kinds of circumstances. And that's actually what they're going to argue. They're going to argue that they are a religious minority. They have the right to discriminate in this narrow, particular way. And they may win. I don't know. So let's pause and ask a couple questions. What are the assumptions that underline the consensus that many PLU have that we won this case? I want to suggest there are at least three key assumptions that underlie it. First, many of us assume that covenants like the Trinity Western Covenant are ahistorical. In fact, that's the way they make their argument, too. Okay? They make their argument that, look, Christians throughout time have all agreed that this is appropriate sexuality and that is an inappropriate sexuality, and this is the good life and that's the bad life, and it's been a no-brainer throughout all of human history or all of Christian history. But actually, fundamentalist Christianity, which is the tradition out of which this group comes, is really, and fundamentalism itself, is really a 20th century phenomenon. It was really unknown before the 20th century. There were points of consensus, but in a kind of a formal ideological sense, it really came into being in the 20th century in an effort to push back certain features of modernity that they didn't like. Okay, so they act like the Trinity Covenant is ahistorical, comes out of the sky, it's obvious to everybody, but it's actually not. And the way they actually articulate it clearly anticipates the modern nature of it. And also the people who are critical of Trinity's covenant also act like it's ahistorical. They also act like, well, this is the way Christians have always thought. And it's, neither one of those is actually true. The covenant really uses modern language and modern legal and human rights language to promote values around which they might organize their lives and their anxiety that they have lost the culture war. This is something I'll return to shortly, but they have this quite clear conviction that they have been losers in the broader cultural war that they feel has been waged against them and against all that is good in the world. Other thing I need to mention is that at Trinity, there's been quite an open discussion, and there continues to be an open discussion among faculty members and among students about the whole covenant question. Okay. I have a number of colleagues who are at Trinity in a number of different academic backgrounds. And many of them are, kind of quite humiliated by this whole process, and they feel like, look, actually, we've been debating the covenant about and trying to tweak it and pressuring the bosses to get them to change things for a long time. And now, with this ruling, with the rulings from the law societies, everybody's dug in their heels, and we feel like we're victims of that heel digging in process. There was an article written in the Province newspaper by a Trinity Western student who says, actually, there is actually talks to get an LGBT group started at Trinity, and there's all manner of debates on sexuality and evolution and so forth underway at Trinity. So the situation is more open there than many of us think, okay? And everybody likes to point out that the covenant, once upon a time, again, because the covenant itself has evolved in its short life, Once upon a time, they weren't even allowed to dance at Trinity, okay? This is something that everyone points out. And so this is a student saying, look, this thing is a moving target. Let's not treat it like it was, you know, it came down from Mount Sinai. Second thing that underlies all this is that there were no other options. Both sides framed it this way, okay? But should we assume that that's true? Should we assume that that's the case? Many of you will remember a number of years ago the debate in Ontario over the Sharia law court cases. And I think I gave a sermon here on that case. Marion Boyd, who was the former Attorney General of Ontario, wrote a report in which she said, look, there are a lot of problems with letting this, you know, basically fundamentalist Muslim group oversee this Sharia court tribunal for family law cases. But if you just follow these 46 provisos that she wrote, everything would be okay. Okay? And actually, a lot of us looked at those 46 provisos and said, well, that's pretty good. Actually, that takes care of all of the concerns that everybody has articulated, from Muslims to feminists, etc. And very quickly, the government just sort of abandoned it for lots of political reasons. But the point is that in Ontario, they at least went through the process of saying, look, here is a political debate. We're being given this ultimatum to let this group of fundamentalist Muslims have a Sharia court tribunal. And what should we do about that? And so they said, well, what we should really do about that is study this. We should really go out into the community, interview people, look for alternatives, look for provisos. What Marion Boyd really recommended was yes with provisos. She said, look, you can have your Sharia courts if you want, because actually Jews and Christians have been doing this for a whole decade with nobody even raising an eyebrow, which is a whole other sermon. And she basically said, look, yeah, you can do this, but we have some legitimate concerns, and here are 46 of them, and here's how we can get around them. But in this case, in the Trinity Western case, people said, no, we're not going to study this. We're not going to insist that both parties separate while we look at other approaches. Both sides framed it as an either-or situation. And finally, this was a problem that we had to go to the mat about. This was a battle we had to fight. Now, look, discrimination of any kind is a real problem. I don't have any concerns about that. It was a real problem. But let's consider other things that we overlook. Let's consider other problems we overlook. So there are, across the country, universities with very poor pay equity records and policies. There are hospitals that don't perform procedures that are legal and safe, and you know what I'm talking about. There is written right into the Canadian Constitution special rights for Catholics in Ontario to get state-funded or provincially funded education for themselves. But if you're a Sikh or a Jew, you don't get that special privilege. Okay, so that's a piece of the Canadian Constitution that nobody wants to change. If you dare utter in public that you want to change that, your career as pretty much anything is over. So the point is just that social change, progress, things moving in the direction of those two big stories we started out with, is discontinuous. Okay, it's discontinuous across institutions, and it's discontinuous within institutions of the same type. In other words, certain hospitals do those procedures, certain hospitals don't. Some universities have fantastic pay equity and maternity leave policies. Some have terrible pay equity and maternity leave policies. Some provinces allow for full funding of religious schools. Some provinces don't allow for any. Some provinces have very complex and sophisticated curricula for teaching kids about sexuality and religion. Some have abysmal programs for that sort of thing. Okay, so within institutions of the same type and across institutions, these changes are occurring slowly. They are occurring, but they're occurring slowly and discontinuously. But in this particular case, the Trinity case, we sort of said, look, the rest of us have made these changes. PLU have all made these decisions that law school should be open to everybody, and there will be no exceptions, right? Even for a sort of a C-list law school in the hinterland that's going to graduate lawyers that none of the good firms are going to hire. That stays in this room, okay? So many people would say, look, this is worth going to the mat over, but all those other things, especially this one, by the way, this fourth one drives me totally insane, okay? So lawyers often talk about the harm, the question of harm. So the question is, there might be a dozen LGBTQ students who want to apply to Trinity and who don't get in because they don't have the appropriate sexual behavior or whatever. That's a bad thing. Again, all discrimination, bad thing. Okay, just want to make sure I've said that. But there are thousands of parents in Ontario who are spending between $10,000 and $20,000 for each kid to go to their Jewish or Muslim private schools. But their Italian neighbors who just arrived, they get their Catholic school paid for nothing. Okay, that's weird, frankly. But everyone kind of goes, meh. And you can believe that if PLU and all the lawyers that like PLU got together and said, you know what, this has to stop. This is outrageous. That it would change. But nobody has the courage to do that. But we all had the courage to say to this little university in the backwoods of BC, graduating again, in many, many years from now, a very small cohort of law students, we had the courage to go to the mat on that one. And that's just a little bit weird. So back to the consensus story, I've mentioned this, right? The kind of story that I think is kind of running the show. But there are other stories and other images. Now let's see how that, look at that, it actually came out. So let me say that there are kind of three images that actually kind of capture some of the other stories. Many people on the left saw the Trinity case as a kind of a Trojan horse. They sort of felt like, look, if we let these people in, if we make this kind of concession for this little group, all hell will break loose, right? The door on the side of that horse is going to open up and all kinds of evangelicals are going to come spilling out of it and, pretty soon cats will be marrying dogs and, who knows what's next, okay? That's the story many, many folks like us told, or that haunted us and that motivated us to get up and protest the Trinity, what Trinity was asking for, but by the way, lets us sleep quite well with the Ontario act of quite explicit discrimination. There's Trinity's story, which is that, look, they're just a religious minority, and, they have some peculiarities, like the Sikhs who want to wear their turbans instead of helmets, and, they're not really hurting anybody, and they're small, and otherwise they pay their taxes, they're nice people. And can't you just leave us alone and give us a little bit of an exception on some of our, atypical practices? Okay, that's sort of their story. Just leave us alone and we won't hurt anybody, and our what we're asking for is really going to harm very, very few people. Okay, that's their argument. And then a third image that kind of captures a little bit more of the way I tend to think of what's going on is to think of Trinity folks as asylum seekers. Okay? This is, I think, a group of men lining up for asylum in France. So when asylum seekers enter the country, we want, we don't have actually, but we want to have a very rigorous legal procedure to determine which ones of them are legitimate asylum seekers and which ones of them aren't, which ones have been trafficked or smuggled, which ones of them aren't, etc. Okay? We want to have a kind of a way of assessing their cases. And so I would suggest that many Trinity people think of themselves really as people seeking some kind of asylum in Canada, asking for a small concession. Now, just I'm mindful of time, so I would just say two thought experiments I encourage you to do on your own is how you would respond if you felt that our society was being managed in a more progressive way. I don't know who this guy is, but I just thought I would put that picture up there in light of the fact that this is probably an election year. So, in other words, if the Trinity request came to you when we were under a different regime, let's say in Canada, would you be more willing to say, oh, well, the whole society is now clearly moving in this progressive direction. This little thing over here, we can kind of tolerate this little weird exception because things, And the second thing is, how would you respond if somebody wanted to create a law school, but the somebody was, instead of a group of evangelical Christians, was a group of Ismaili Muslims. Those are the most progressive contemporary cosmopolitan Muslims. And in it, they have a Sharia law component, as they would have if they were going to be funding a law school. This is Aga Khan and company. And they have a rule where non-Ismaili Muslims can't worship in their mosques. Okay, so those are two thought experiments you can think about. So I think a lot has to do with how one says no. Okay, so let me just wrap up this way by saying, when we use the coercive power of the state or professional associations in response to a minority community, there should be a burden on the now dominant community, which are, frankly, PLU and the law societies running in an effort to protect the charter and the orientations of PLU. And I think if we're going to say no, or when we say no, there should be three things we do. First, we should reflect openly, not just upon our complicity in past injustices, I'm talking about residential schools and other things, of course, but also those injustices in which we currently participate, even if only tacitly. Okay? So let's say, look, okay, yes, we're going to say no to you, but yeah, there's that whole Ontario special rights for Catholics thing. Yeah, there's University X and Y that's not really that good to disabled people or women or whatever. And, you know, and then you have to have this kind of a list of, yeah. So, again, so I think it's important to be open about that. Second, when we use the coercive power of the state or professional associations to say no, we should ask ourselves also this. What are the consequences of saying no? If we say no in a cold, bureaucratic, administrative way, what are the consequences? Might it lead to what we would call radicalization in other religious spheres? Because I know a lot of my friends at Trinity, actually, are very worried, actually, that all their peers and their bosses are becoming radicalized. That is to say, they're digging in their heels, their theology, their views of the other are kind of ossifying, and they're worried that's going to happen. Many of my friends are trying to leave. And might it be possible to have a yes with provisos? Might it even be preferable to seek that as a kind of a solution? Again, all solutions are temporary solutions, right? So because everything is always changing. And finally, when we use the coercive power of the state to say no to a minority community, members of the now dominant community, should ask ourselves what kind of symbolic work our no is doing. I had long debates with a dear friend of mine who's a lawyer, quite a prominent lawyer in the city. And I said to her, well, what do you think's going on here? And she wrote this to me, and I thought this so beautifully captured a part of what was happening here, but no one else had actually articulated it in this way. I think it might have been, and she's referring here to the no vote of the BC Law Society, I think it might have been an act of rebellion against the horror many of us feel about the role of Harper's brand of religion in running the state. We were given an opportunity to draw a line in the sand, and we drew it. So in other words, this proposal from Trinity becomes a kind of a battleground on which other battles are fought. And it's just important to say, oh, that's interesting. That's the other thing that's going on here. Okay? So in conclusion, we have transformed our society in many ways. The coming into being of these two powerful stories, the consensual, if you will, Western liberal democratic story and the Unitarian story. These are great stories, and we have worked very hard to bring them into being. And there is a lot of work to be done to bring them into being in their fullness, for sure. But now that liberals seem to be winning the, if you will, the long game of the democratic struggle, we can't lapse into triumphalism. There is a reason to protect and advance and celebrate the hard-won consensus around liberal, political, and religious values. But I think we are also called to bear witness to the pain that our no and that our values cause groups that suddenly find themselves to be vulnerable in a world in which so few touchstones are left for them. That doesn't mean we don't say no. It just means we're more mindful when we do say no. And there are probably better and worse ways of saying no. Thank you.